We'll be starting our scripture reading today with 2 Samuel, basically 2 Samuel 11, the entire chapter. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab with his officers and all Israel with him. They ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. David sent someone to inquire about this woman. It was reported, "This is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite." So David sent messengers to get her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself after her period. Then she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab and the people fared and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the entrance of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. When they told David Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "You've just come from a journey. Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah remain in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do such a thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day. On the next day, David invited him to eat and drink in his presence and made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In this letter, he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him so that he may be struck down and die." As Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant warriors. The men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite was killed as well. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, "When you finish telling the king all the news about the fighting, then if the king's anger rises, and if he says to you, 'Why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Elimelech, son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebez? Why did you go so near the wall?' Then you shall say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead too.'" So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had said to tell him. The messenger said to David, "The men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, and we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also." David said to the messenger, "Thus you shall say to Joab, 'Do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Press your attack on the city and overthrow it,' and encourage him." When the wife of Uriah the Hittite heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for him. When the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. May the Lord add a blessing to the reading of his word.
It seems like when you're worship leader and I'm preaching that it always ends up being a long or difficult passage like that. It's not on purpose, but well, the band The 77s, in their song "The Lust, the Flesh, the Eyes, and the Pride of Life," sing, "Well, I feel like I have to feel something good all the time. With most of my life I cannot deal, but a good feeling I can feel, even though it may not be real. And if a person, place, or thing can deliver, I will quiver with delight. But will it last me for all my life, or just one more lonely night? The lust, the flesh, the eyes, and the pride of life drain the life right out of me." Lust is a deceptive vice. It promises good feelings, delight, and pleasure, yet these things don't last more than a lonely night. In fact, giving in to lust can feel like it is giving life, but it truly does drain the life out of us, keeping us from the life that really is life, a life lived in the fullness of God's love. Lust promises the pleasure and joy of true love, but actually gives emptiness and loneliness instead. Now, lust is a craving or desire for the pleasures of the body. We can lust after food or money or possessions, but most often, lust is about sexual desire. And it reduces sexual gratification to one's own physical, individual self-gratification. Our sexuality is good, and it is given to us by God. And the act of sex is perhaps the most physically intimate connection that two people can have. As I think about that, the only thing that perhaps is more intimate is that of giving birth and breastfeeding. There's a deeply intimate connection between mother and child as one life produces and sustains another. Now, we all long, without whether we realize it or not, for connection and intimacy with others. And unfortunately, that desire for intimacy or relationship or connection is not always found. After all, it takes work to establish meaningful relationships. So instead, we can fall victim to lust, which does not honor the fullness of love as God intends for us all. Lust can do two major things. First, it focuses desire and attention on another person instead of God or instead of one's spouse, whom one is committed to love and cherish above all others. Now, some people say that lust is one of the lesser sins because it creates a focus on another person, love for another person, which generally is a good thing. However, that love of an individual can replace our love for God, seeking wholeness from human relationships rather than from God. But more so, lust takes shape in a second way. It more often focuses on one's personal pleasure and not the actual good of another person or the God-given wholeness of either you or the object of your desire. So even though another person is involved, the one who is lusting is using that other person for their own pleasure, not for that person's well-being. They are not fully considering that other person as a child of God, as loved by God, as worthy of love and wholeness and the life that really is life, to use that phrase again. They are considering that person only for that person's physical attributes and for their own sexual pleasure. Now, pornography is a huge example of this kind of lust, and in return feeds lust. And I think when we speak about pornography, we need to be realistic about what that really means. It's not just Playboy or Playgirl magazines. It's not just what you find on the internet. It is prime time and anytime TV that features sexually charged situations. It's the Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition. It's billboards for so-called gentlemen's clubs. It is anything that starts or feeds that fire of sexual desire. And when a person consumes pornography in any form, they are serving their own desires. They are treating the person that they see as an object. And that object of desire is not seen for who they truly are or who they truly can be. They are seeing through the eyes of personal pleasure rather than through the eyes of God. Pornography devalues the person being objectified, and it devalues the consumer as well. Another attribute of lust is that it perpetuates itself or escalates until some sort of breaking point. It's not easily squelched, but rather grows and grows until some sort of outside force, whether that's good or bad, breaks in and cuts off that lust. So David's lust for Bathsheba is an example of how this escalation can take place. David's actions escalated from lust to deceit to murder. The story in 2 Samuel 11 puts David in a questionable position right from the start, actually. We read that David is in Jerusalem while he has sent his army out to battle. So it was customary that kings went out with their armies to battle. But for some reason, David decides instead that he's going to stay at home and hang out on his couch. And this turns out to be a very bad decision. While he is in his palace, he goes to the roof and he sees the beautiful Bathsheba bathing on her roof somewhere below the palace. And now here's the thing. Him spotting Bathsheba could have been innocent. He could have noticed her beauty, quickly turned away, gone back into the palace, and we wouldn't be reading this story today at all. Humans are certainly attracted to each other, And that isn't a bad thing in and of itself. We see someone, we notice their beauty, we may feel attracted to them. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it becomes something wrong when we begin to seek our own pleasure from seeing that person, when we stop seeing that person as a child of God and rather as an object of desire. In fact, one way to help curb lust is to pray for the person that you see and feel attracted to. If you pray for that person and try to see them as God sees them, then you're less likely for that attraction to turn into lust. But David doesn't do any of that. His lust begins to burn, and he watches her, then sends to find out who she is, and finally has his people bring her to him so that he could sleep with her, allowing his lust to produce adultery. When he finds out that Bathsheba is pregnant, he brings Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, home from the battlefield to try to create a scenario where Uriah and Bathsheba could be together and make it seem that the baby was his. However, Uriah is an honorable soldier, more honorable than David, and he won't go home while his fellow soldiers are still out fighting. So David takes things a step further and has the commander of his army put Uriah into a situation where he will surely be killed, which he is. David's actions displeased God, and in chapter 12, which we didn't read all of that chapter as well, but in chapter 12, we have the story of the prophet Nathan coming to David and condemning his actions, helping David realize what he did. David sees the fullness of his error and of his sin, and he repents. But even with that repentance, there still were consequences that David has to deal with. Lust is one-sided love. David had no consideration for Bathsheba or Uriah. All he was concerned with was his own gratification. He saw what he wanted, and he took it. He used Bathsheba for his benefit, rather than forming a two-way mutual love relationship, which I suppose wasn't really possible in those circumstances anyway. And there are relationships in our time, even marriages, that are based more on lust than on love. One or both partners cannot see past their own desires. They see their partner only in how that person can benefit them, and not in how they can benefit their partner or how they can benefit each other even more so. True love seeks to know how God has formed their beloved and longs to grow closer to them so that they can love more and more as God does. Lust takes something good, our sexuality, and it abuses it for self, cheapening the beauty of our God-given sexuality and need for relationship. Instead of a love that sees one another as children of God, beloved of God, we see one another as objects to satisfy our own desire. Not only does it hurt our relationships with others, but it keeps us from being fully who God has made each of us to be.